Hello and welcome to the Pediatric Critical Care Medicine Audio Abstracts. I'm Dr. Erin Bennett, and on behalf of PCCM, I'm happy to present this audio recording of the research abstracts that appear in this month's issue. Let's get started. Abstract 1 is a featured original research article by Balaglu et al., Performance of Supervised Machine Learning Models for Cardiac Surgery-Associated Acute Kidney Injury in Children, Multicenter Retrospective Cohort Study from 2019 to 2022. Objectives: to derive and externally validate supervised machine learning models predictive of cardiac surgery-associated acute kidney injury. Design: retrospective cohort analysis. Setting: 4 multicenter cardiac surgical centers from January 2019 to February 2022. Patients: 7 days to 18 years old who had undergone cardiac surgery. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Cardiac surgery-associated acute kidney injury was defined using kidney disease improved global outcomes criteria, with stages 2 and 3 classified as severe during the first 7 postoperative days. Data analysis followed 2 approaches: 1, combining 3 centers for derivation and using a 4th for external validation, and 2, randomly dividing the entire data set into derivation and validation cohorts in a 4-to-1 ratio. 40 machine learning models were developed across 5 derivation validation pairs using 4 machine learning algorithms, including light gradient boosting machine, extreme gradient boosting, categorical boosting, and histogram gradient boosting, to predict 2 outcomes: any and severe cardiac surgery-associated acute kidney injury, utilizing preoperative, intraoperative, and immediate postoperative variables. Shapley additive explanations was used for input variable importance analysis. A cohort of 1,100 patients was analyzed. Any cardiac surgery-associated acute kidney injury and severe cardiac surgery-associated acute kidney injury occurred in 49.1% and 23.1% of patients, respectively. Wide range of variations in external validation of model performance were observed among all 40 machine learning models. For any cardiac surgery-associated acute kidney injury, the range in metrics were: area under the receiver operating characteristic curve 0.64 to 0.83, sensitivity 0.29 to 0.86, specificity 0.46 to 0.95, positive predictive value 0.5 to 0.85, and negative predictive value 0.6 to 0.86. For severe cardiac surgery-associated acute kidney injury, we found the range in metrics with area under the receiver operating characteristic curve 0.65 to 0.77, sensitivity 0.04 to 0.58, specificity 0.77 to 0.99, positive predictive value 0.32 to 0.75, and negative predictive value 0.78 to 0.9. Preoperative serum creatinine, cardiopulmonary bypass, aortic cross clamp duration, weight, and age at surgery were the most important predictors associated with cardiac surgery-associated acute kidney injury. Conclusions: this analysis of a retrospective multicenter dataset shows that external performance of machine learning models vary, highlighting challenges in generalizability, which may be due to center-based differences in practice. Abstract 2 is a featured original research article by Gouda et al., Pediatric Palliative Care Consultation in the PICU Following Out-of-Hospital Cardiac Arrest, Analysis of the U.S. Pediatric Health Information Systems Database from 2013 to 2023. Objectives: subspecialty pediatric palliative care team consultation is an integral component of comprehensive care provided to critically ill children. Little is known about the utilization of subspecialty pediatric palliative care following out-of-hospital cardiac arrests in the United States. Our objectives were to examine subspecialty pediatric palliative care utilization following out-of-hospital cardiac arrest and compare characteristics between children who did and did not receive subspecialty pediatric palliative care consultation. Design: retrospective cohort study. Setting: 47 U.S. children's hospitals participating in the Pediatric Health Information Systems Database. Patients: children younger than 21 years old with PICU admissions from 2013 to 2023 following out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. The primary outcome was receipt of subspecialty pediatric palliative care consultation as identified by International Classification of Diseases codes. Patient characteristics and outcomes were compared between those with and without subspecialty pediatric palliative care consultation. Multiple logistic regression models were fitted to identify factors associated with greater odds of receiving subspecialty pediatric palliative care. Of 1,530 pediatric patients hospitalized after out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, 198, or 13%, received subspecialty pediatric palliative care consultation. Subspecialty pediatric palliative care consultation versus not was more common among patients with complex chronic conditions, 97% versus 85%, and a p-value less than 0.001, and was associated with the following: longer hospital stay, median 4 versus 2 days and a p-value less than 0.001, new medical technology, including feeding tube, 8.1% versus 3.8% and a p-value equal to 0.006, and tracheostomy, 8.6% versus 3.2% and a p-value less than 0.001, and in-hospital mortality, 82% versus 66% and a p-value less than 0.001. Multivariable analysis suggested the odds of subspecialty pediatric palliative care consultation increased by 21% for each additional complex chronic condition, with an odds ratio of 1.21 and a 95% confidence interval of 1.11 to 1.32, and by 12% annually between 2013 and 2023, with an odds ratio of 1.12 and a 95% confidence interval of 1.06 to 1.18. Conclusions. Despite the high morbidity and mortality associated with pediatric out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, subspecialty pediatric palliative care consultations were used infrequently and disproportionately concentrated among children with pre-existing medical complexity or imminent death. Since all PICU children post-out-of-hospital cardiac arrest may benefit from subspecialty pediatric palliative care consultation, future studies should focus on barriers and opportunities for subspecialty pediatric palliative care integration into standard care. Abstract 3 is a featured original research article by Korb et al. Multi-site veno-venous extracorporeal membrane oxygenation in pediatric patients under 15 kilograms. Three-center analysis of surgical versus percutaneous approach and thrombosis risk from 2017 to 2024. Objectives. An increasing number of pediatric centers use the femoral vein in neonates and smaller children to provide veno-venous multi-site extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, or ECMO, but there are no studies comparing surgical versus percutaneous approaches. We investigated the thrombosis risk associated with veno-venous multi-site, comparing outcomes between the surgical and percutaneous approach. Design, retrospective data analysis. Setting, Evelina London Children's Hospital, Haim Powell Hospital, and Semmelweis University from 2017 to 2024. Patients, we included 58 neonatal and pediatric patients weighing less than 15 kilograms supported with veno-venous multi-site ECMO for respiratory disease. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. We collected patient and veno-venous ECMO details, thrombosis of cannulated vessels as determined by a pediatric radiologist via follow-up vascular ultrasound was the primary outcome. In total, 58 patients received veno-venous multisite, survived, and were assessed for thrombosis. There were 34 surgically cannulated patients with median weight 3.6 kilograms and an interquartile range of 2.8 to 7 kilograms versus 24 percutaneously cannulated patients with a median weight of 8 kilograms and an interquartile range of 3.7 to 12.3 kilograms who were cannulated by pediatric anesthetists or intensive care physicians. Surgical placement of cannulas in comparison with percutaneous placement was associated with greater odds of thrombosis of internal jugular and femoral veins, with an odds ratio of 37, a 95% confidence interval of 7 to 266, although the surgical group were younger and of lower weight, with a p-value less than 0.005. For any given weight, percutaneously placed cannulas were smaller than those placed surgically, yet they still provided adequate ECMO flow. Conclusions. This retrospective case series of veno-venous multisite in neonates and small children less than 15 kilograms shows that surgical cannulation was associated with greater odds of vascular thrombosis at vessel sites, but a potential confounder may be that the surgical group were younger and of smaller weight. Overall, for any given weight, percutaneous cannulas were smaller than those placed surgically. Abstract 4 is a clinical investigation article by Stevens et al. High-dose insulin for calcium channel blocker and beta blocker poisoning in children, referrals to the Minnesota Regional Poison Center from 2000 to 2024. Objectives. High-dose insulin is a unique therapy for beta blocker and calcium channel blocker poisonings. we have examined pediatric patients with beta blocker and or calcium channel blocker poisonings who received high-dose insulin therapy with the purpose of describing the clinical characteristics associated with these poisonings and the treatment. Design: retrospective database study using our regional three-state poison center at the Minnesota Regional Poison Center. We identified all children treated with high-dose insulin for beta blocker and or calcium channel blocker poisonings between the years 2000 and 2024. Setting: regional poison center data. Patients: pediatric patients 18 years old or younger. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. We identified 36 patients with a median age of 16 years, range 7 months to 18 years. There were 24 of 36 females and 14 of 36 patients were poisoned with beta blockers, 16 of 36 patients by calcium channel blockers, and 6 of 36 patients by both drugs. The median peak insulin infusion rate was 1 unit per kilogram per hour with a range of 0.5 to 11 units per kilogram per hour. The median insulin infusion duration was 23 hours with a range of 1 to 136 hours. The mean dextrose infusion concentration was 37% with a range of 5 to 70%. Vasopressors were used in 23 of 36 cases. Median vasopressor duration was 38 hours with a range of 1 to 199 hours. Cardiac arrest occurred in 4 of 36 patients. Life support with extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, or ECMO, was used in 1 patient. 3 patients died as a result of poisoning. Conclusions: in our three-state poison center, over a 25-year period from 2000 to 2024, high-dose insulin was predominantly used in adolescents with intentional beta-blocker or calcium channel blocker overdoses. No adverse events required early discontinuation of high-dose insulin. Escalation to ECMO support was rare. More experience is needed to evaluate the safety and effectiveness of high-dose insulin in small children. Abstract 5 is a clinical investigation article by Schwartz et al., Management Options for Chylothorax After Vascular Ring Repair, Retrospective Multicenter Cohort in the United States from 2021 to 2023. Objectives: chylothorax after vascular ring repair is likely secondary to direct injury to the lymphatic collection system and may benefit from tailored management. We have reviewed the management of patients with chylothorax following vascular ring repair and compared the approaches to chylothorax care after all other cardiac surgeries. Design: retrospective multicenter cohort. Setting: 10 pediatric cardiac surgical centers in the United States. Patients: children with chylothorax after vascular ring repair at participating pediatric cardiac surgical centers from January 1, 2021 to December 31, 2023. Analysis was stratified by chylothorax patients with vascular ring surgery versus all other cardiac surgeries. Results: overall, 45 patients had chylothorax following vascular ring repair, 45 of 340 or 13.2%, in comparison to 384 patients who had chylothorax following all cardiac surgeries, including vascular repair and Fontan procedure, 384 of 8,494 or 4.5%. Compared with all other cardiac surgeries, a higher proportion of vascular ring patients than other cardiac surgical cases underwent invasive lymphatic intervention, including thoracic duct ligation, embolization, and pleuridesis, 10 of 45 versus 19 of 314, and a p-value equal to 0.001, and at an earlier median interval from index surgery, 3.5 versus 28 days, with a p-value less than 0.001. The 10 patients with vascular ring who underwent a lymphatic intervention had higher chest tube output on postoperative days 2, 9.2 versus 2.6 milliliters per kilogram per day and a p-value equal to 0.005, and postoperative day 3, 4.9 versus 0.6 milliliters per kilogram per day with a p-value equal to 0.002, compared with those who resolved without an invasive lymphatic intervention. Following lymphatic intervention, chylothorax resolved a median of 1 day later, and there were 0 of 10 procedure-related complications. Conclusions: patients with chylothorax after vascular ring more commonly undergo invasive intervention when compared with those with other surgeries. Chest tube output on postoperative days 2 and 3 may help differentiate vascular ring patients who will need invasive intervention. Chylothorax resolves soon after invasive intervention in vascular ring patients, and in our cohort of 10, there were no procedural related complications. Abstract 6 is a clinical investigation article by Kui et al. Baseline serum vitamin C levels in pediatric sepsis, hazard of mortality and organ dysfunction in a single center prospective cohort. Objectives: to explore whether baseline serum vitamin C levels are associated with 28-day mortality and organ dysfunction in pediatric sepsis. Design: single center prospective cohort from 2021 to 2023. Setting: tertiary children's hospital PICU in China. Patients 18 years old or younger with suspected infection and organ dysfunction. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Serum vitamin C concentrations were measured in 141 patients within 24 hours of PICU admission. The median vitamin C level was 4.3 micrograms per milliliter with an interquartile range of 2.5 to 7.2. Patients were categorized into quartiles, and the primary endpoint was 28-day mortality. The secondary endpoint was the Pediatric Sequential Organ Failure Assessment, or PSOFA score, on day 1. Overall, a quarter of our cohort were deficient in vitamin C with a level less than 2.5 micrograms per milliliter. In multivariable Cox and linear regression analyses, each one standard deviation, or 3.04 micrograms per milliliter increase in vitamin C, was associated with a 52% reduction in 28-day mortality, with an adjusted hazard ratio of 0.48 and a 95% confidence interval of 0.3 to 0.76, and a 0.67-point decrease in PSOFA, with a beta of negative 0.67 and a 95% confidence interval of negative 1.1 to negative 0.22. Compared with quarter 1, quarter 3 had the lowest adjusted hazard of mortality, with a hazard ratio of 0.19 and a 95% confidence interval of 0.05 to 0.7, and the least severe organ dysfunction, with a beta of negative 1.5 and a p-value equal to 0.018. Restricted cubic spline analysis suggested a linear inverse relationship between vitamin C and mortality, but a nonlinear inverse association with PSOFA. Subgroup analyses demonstrated more pronounced associations in patients not receiving corticosteroids and in those with normal renal function. Conclusions: in children with suspected infection and organ dysfunction, subsequent 28-day mortality and organ dysfunction are associated with serum vitamin C level in the first 24 hours of PICU admission. Abstract 7 is a clinical investigation article by La Rosa et al. Increasing nurse-led mobilization of critically ill children through in situ simulation, a quality improvement initiative. Objective: critically ill children are at risk for preventable morbidities due to immobility. Early mobility, a key component of the ICU liberation bundle, improves outcomes and reduces mortality. Internationally, adherence to early mobility protocols is low, and nurses are pivotal for success. This quality improvement, or QI, initiative aimed to assess whether an in situ early mobility simulation for PICU nurses increased nurse-led mobilization of critically ill children. Design: QI initiative with an observational pre-post design. Setting: PICU in a tertiary academic hospital in the United States. Patients: critically ill pediatric patients admitted to the PICU. Intervention: an in situ early mobility simulation session for PICU nurses. Measurements and main results. Data were collected and analyzed from February to October 2024 on randomly selected shifts in the pre-intervention N=22 day shifts and post-intervention N=26 day shifts phases. 101 children 1 to 17 years old who were admitted to the PICU and had length of stay greater than or equal to 72 hours were included. 80% of all critical care nurses, or 80 of 100, participated in the simulation session. Post-intervention, the median number of nurse-led mobilizations per patient in a 12-hour shift increased from 5 to 6 with a p-value equal to 0.02. Participation in the simulation was associated with an increase of 1.9 mobilizations per patient in a 12-hour shift after adjusting for age, illness severity, functional status, and mobility level, with a p-value equal to 0.004. Nursing knowledge of patients' mobility levels improved, with a p-value equal to 0.004, and self-efficacy in mobilizing critically ill children increased from 67% to 93%, with a p-value less than 0.001. No significant increase in safety events was observed. Conclusions: in situ early mobility simulations for PICU nurses increased nurse-led mobilizations of critically ill children without compromising safety. Further research is needed to explore the long-term impact and generalizability of this curriculum. Abstract 8 is an original research article by Fascina et al. Structured Nurse-Led PICU Liberation Bundle, ABCDEF Discussion During Rounds, a single-center secondary analysis of pre- versus post-implementation data from 2017. Objective: the Society of Critical Care Medicine PICU Liberation ABCDEF Campaign Collaborative aimed to implement best practices for analgesia, A, breathing, B, comfort and consciousness, C, delirium, D, early mobilization, E, and family engagement and empowerment, F. Our post-hoc study of Mayo Clinic data sought to compare the pre-implementation rounding process, which used a nursing script organized by organ systems, with a novel, liberation-focused rounding process emphasizing A to F bundle elements. Design: secondary analysis of pre- versus post-implementation surveys collected by independent observers during rounds. Setting: medical-surgical PICU in a quaternary care academic medical center during April to July of 2017. Subjects: the observed participants included PICU physicians, nurses, respiratory therapists, pharmacists, and dietitians. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results: survey responses from 145 team members pre-implementation and 67 post-implementation showed improved team satisfaction, communication, and understanding of daily plans, all with a p-value less than 0.05. Respondents reported an increased frequency of discussions on bundle components A to E, all with a p-value less than 0.01. Observations of 41 pre-implementation and 46 post-implementation rounds showed an increase in the frequency of discussion of all components of the bundle, all with a p-value less than 0.01. However, this finding was not at the expense of increased duration of individual rounds, since we failed to find a difference in pre- versus post-implementation duration per patient, 480 versus 544 seconds per patient, with a p-value equal to 0.2. Conclusions: in 2017, around the time of introducing the nurse-led PICU liberation rounding process to our practice, we found that after implementation, there was an associated increase in discussions about bundle elements and improved communications and satisfaction in team members. Abstract 9 is an original research article by Havlicek et al. Hospital-acquired venous thromboembolism among children with tracheostomy, a North American Virtual Pediatric Systems Registry study from 2016 to 2023. Objective: to evaluate the frequency of hospital-acquired venous thromboembolism, or hospital-acquired VTE, including limb and neck deep venous thrombosis, pulmonary embolism, and organ-specific VTE among critically ill children with tracheostomy, and determine whether surrogate markers of impaired mobility, IDEST invasive mechanical ventilation, or a high-intensity neurologic diagnosis are associated with hospital-acquired VTE. Design: multi-center retrospective study of the Virtual Pediatric Systems Database from January 1, 2016 to December 31, 2023. Setting: 142 North American PICUs. Patients: children younger than 18 years with a pre-existing tracheostomy, excluding neonatal and postoperative encounters, those with a PICU length of stay less than 1 day, and those with VTE present at admission. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results: of 25,560 encounters, 181, or 0.7%, developed a hospital-acquired VTE identified at a median of 9.5 days with an interquartile range of 4 to 19 days following hospitalization. Although a larger proportion of children who developed a hospital-acquired VTE as compared with not had a high-intensity neurologic diagnosis, 66.9% versus 56.6%, and a p-value equal to 0.006, and greater rate of invasive mechanical ventilation exposure, 92.8% versus 81.6%, and a p-value less than 0.001, these immobility surrogate markers were not associated with hospital-acquired VTE in an adjusted logistic regression model. Features independently associated with hospital-acquired VTE included prior VTE with an adjusted odds ratio of 19.2 and a 95% confidence interval of 7.1 to 52, central venous catheterization with an adjusted odds ratio of 3 and a 95% confidence interval of 2.1 to 4.2, comorbid infection with an adjusted odds ratio of 2.2 and a 95% confidence interval of 1.6 to 3.2, and an inherited hypercoagulability with an adjusted odds ratio of 3.5 and a 95% confidence interval of 2.6 to 5.7. All p-values were less than 0.001. Among patients with central venous catheterization, concomitant high-intensity neurologic impairment diagnosis with an adjusted odds ratio of 1.7 and a 95% confidence interval of 1.1 to 2.8 was independently associated with hospital-acquired VTE. Conclusions. In this multi-center study of critically ill children with tracheostomy, hospital-acquired VTE occurred in 0.7% of encounters and was associated with presence of a central venous catheter, comorbid infection, prior VTE, and inherited hypercoagulability. A surrogate marker of immobility, IDEST, high-intensity neurologic diagnoses, was associated with hospital-acquired VTE among patients with a central venous catheter. Abstract 10 is a clinical investigation article by Maeda et al. Speakeasy, a multidisciplinary quality improvement initiative to increase face-to-face language interpreting in the PICU. Objectives: to improve communication with caregivers who prefer a language other than English by increasing interpreting encounters with an emphasis on face-to-face, in-person, or video modalities. Design: single-center quality improvement initiative. Setting: 75-bed PICU in a quaternary children's hospital. Patients: patients whose caregivers preferred a language other than English during the period from March 2023 to December 2024. Interventions: based on clinician and nursing input about barriers to using interpreting services, we enacted a bundle of interventions collectively known as the Speakeasy Program, which included 1. Multidisciplinary education, 2. Preferred language signs, 3. A novel, standardized opt-out in-person interpreting program for caregivers whose preferred language was Spanish, and 4. Increased number of video interpreting devices and presence of devices in patient rooms. Measurements and main results. We analyzed total and face-to-face interpreting encounters during the intervention period from March 2023 to December 2024, compared with the pre-intervention period from November 2021 to February 2023, using statistical process control charts. Total interpreting encounters nearly tripled from 43 to 121 encounters per 100 language other than English patient days, and face-to-face interpreting encounters increased by more than 4 times from 23 to 104 encounters per 100 language other than English patient days. Significant shifts were driven by increases in the number of in-person Spanish interpreting encounters and video interpreting encounters following interventions 3 and 4. Pre-intervention surveys reveal that time constraints, unpredictability, and competing priorities represent barriers to using interpreting services that may be particularly relevant in high acuity settings. Post-intervention surveys show that clinicians, nurses, and social workers viewed the changes that were made favorably. Conclusions: a multidisciplinary approach emphasizing interventions to decrease the time and planning necessary to coordinate in-person and video interpreting can effectively engender cultural change and promote the delivery of language-concordant care. Abstract 11 is the PCCM trial by Menon et al. Stress hydrocortisone in pediatric septic shock, protocol for a pragmatic multicenter international randomized double-blinded placebo-controlled interventional trial. Objectives: septic shock accounts for approximately 8% of PICU admissions worldwide, carries significant morbidity, and has a reported mortality rate between 5% and 50% depending upon the geographic region in which it occurs. Design: pragmatic multicenter international randomized double-blinded placebo-controlled interventional trial. Setting: approximately 50 PICUs from 11 countries in North America, South America, and Asia. Patients: up to 500 eligible pediatric patients aged 1 month to 17 years and 8 months with septic shock. Interventions: patients randomized to the hydrocortisone arm receive 1 initial bolus of 2 mg per kilogram IV hydrocortisone, followed by 1 mg per kilogram every 6 hours until all vasoactive inotropic infusions have been discontinued for at least 12 hours or for a maximum of 7 days. Patients randomized to the placebo arm receive an equivalent volume of normal saline with the identical dosing schedule. Measurements and main results: The primary outcome is the frequency of new or progressive multiple organ dysfunction syndrome up to 28 days following enrollment, death, or discharge, whichever comes first. The secondary outcome is a composite of the frequency of death or greater than or equal to 25% decrease in health-related quality of life from baseline assessed at 28 days. Conclusions. The current pediatric surviving sepsis guidelines do not provide definitive recommendations regarding the use of corticosteroids in pediatric septic shock. Our study will be the first pediatric trial that is adequately powered to assess both potential benefits and adverse effects of corticosteroids in patients with septic shock. The results of this study will provide definitive data upon which to base future recommendations for corticosteroid administration in pediatric septic shock. The PCCM narrative this month is entitled The Language of Small Gestures by Dr. Sylvia Belda-Huffines. He died yesterday, a wordless death, slow and unhurried, unfolding as a quiet presence shared among us, until death rose victorious and carried him away. The child who once lived in that fragile little body is now gone, but the memory of him will remain with me always. He lived a silent life, the life of a sick child. Always lying down, he grew just enough to reach 12, although instead of a preteen, he was barely heavier than an infant cradled in one's arms, just skin and bones. His legs were so thin, I could wrap my hand entirely around his calf. I met him only days ago when he arrived in our PICU with respiratory distress, transferred from another hospital. A fine-featured face, pale skin, and chestnut hair that turned copper in the sunlight. A body diminished by seizures, so many that they had stolen every expression, every chance to respond to a world that kept turning while he, depending on his position, could see only a corner of life, a square of existence he could not reach. From the moment I saw him, I knew, clearly and brutally, that even something as banal as a cold could mean his death. And I realized his parents didn't yet share that awareness. They only vaguely sensed the shadow that had followed them for years, growing quietly until now it stood tall behind them, ready to flood everything with grief. He was awaiting a gastrostomy at another hospital. Until now, he'd never needed home oxygen, rarely required admission. I knew little of his family except that his parents were divorced. I wondered what had ended that love, how much their child's illness had weighed on them, how many fears and silences lay between them. I spoke with each parent separately, then together. I watched their faces and timing, trying to read the emotion behind their gazes as they looked at their son, lying still, turned toward that tiny patch of life. I wish I could have gotten ahead of it. Too often I arrive late to that conversation. In my corner of the world, surrounded by machines and sick children, death is always nearby. Still, I struggle with the idea that I may be the first to speak its name to those who have spent years wrapping their child in caress, in daily gestures of love, in silent hope. It feels wrong that I should be the one to introduce death. One night, he deteriorated suddenly. He was intubated and ventilated. Just like that, illness painted death plainly across his parents' faces. I spoke gently, pacing my words to the rhythm of his small, fragile body. Words clean and careful, chosen with the tenderness his quiet life deserved. We talked about death and how to die, and whether to tether him to the ventilator, to fill his days with the sound of that machine. In the room, I saw them consciously listen to that sound for the first time. Saw them watching him with new eyes, now aware that time had always been the judge, and the verdict long written. Those early seizures had already begun to restrict his life to the square of wall he could see from his bed. The sentence had always been there, buried deep, as if hiding it beneath affection might soften its blow. We brought it out slowly and carefully to place the present moment within the arc of his life. And, in their eyes, I saw tenderness, even as death left its mark. Their touch changed. Their gestures grew smaller, but infinitely more meaningful. Boundless love, newly sharpened. When we removed the ventilator, the options were clear. Either he would breathe on his own, or we would care for him gently, free from the artificial rhythm of a machine his body no longer understood. In the hours that followed, the reality of his illness became undeniable. Although just 12, he bore the weight of a lifetime. The small view he had of the world widened slowly as he seemed to move toward freedom beyond illness, no longer chained to seizures or limited by the angle of his pillow. We stayed for hours saying goodbye. His parents took turns, sometimes sitting side by side. Silences hung between them, words unspoken beneath the soft shroud of farewell. They offered presence, a quiet attention, listening to shallow breaths, hearing gurgles of unexpected strength from that tiny chest. He took his time, slowly releasing the fragile life he had lived. Perhaps the way we die reflects the way we lived. Slowly, gently, through small gestures, just as he had lived, nearly expressionless, yet surrounded by constant, tender care, a lion's heart in a battered body. His heart beat for hours, each breath faint but determined, as if gathering strength to go just a little further. I stayed there with them, a witness, until he finally broke free. I imagined him rising into that immense space that always belonged to him. I don't know whether he became a star with clear, white light, or lives on in the deep, unreadable gazes of his parents. But he's still here, for me too, in an undefined ethereal space. I left behind my own small goodbye, a final touch on that light body, now filled only with soft spaces. The final embrace, shared in turns by his parents, two distant lives reunited at his bedside, became a ritual of love, a farewell to the child they cherished. A small life, made of small gestures, now carried forever in their memories and in my fingertips, where I held his delicate wrist. He died yesterday, a quiet, slow, and gentle death. And when I went out running that night under the black sky beneath the immeasurable universe above my head, I imagined him there. This concludes the abstracts for the January 2026 issue of Pediatric Critical Care Medicine. Thank you very much for listening. For more journal-related content, including access to the articles mentioned in this recording, please visit pccmjournal.org. Members of the SCCM Pediatric Section receive complimentary access to the PCCM Journal.